In the soothing reek of his tobacconist's quiet stockroom at the corner of Chancery Lane and Carey Street, Oliphant held the corner of the blue flimsy above the concise jet of a bronze cigar lighter in the shape of a turbaned Turk. He watched the paper reduce itself to delicate pinkish ash. The satchel had contained a Ballester Molina automatic revolver, a silvered brass pocket flask filled with some sickly, sweet-scented decoction, and a wooden case. This last was plainly the object in question, encrusted as it was with raw white plaster. It held a very large number of engine cards in the Napoleon gauge, cut from a novel material, milky and very smooth to the touch. "The parcel," he said to Mr. Beeden, the tobacconist, "is to be held for me alone."
"Certainly, sir."
"My man Bligh to be the sole exception?"
"As you wish, sir."
"If any inquiry at all shall be made, Beeden, please send a boy round to advise Bligh."
"Our pleasure, sir."
"Thank you, Beeden. Could you possibly give me £40 cash against my account?"
"40, sir?"
"Yes."
"Yes, I could, sir. With pleasure, Mr. Oliphant."
Mr. Beeden took a ring of keys from his coat and went to unlock an admirably modern-looking safe. "And a dozen prime Habanas. And Beeden?"
"Yes, sir."
"I think it might be a very good idea if you were to keep the parcel in your safe there."
"Of course, sir."
"I believe that the Lambs is nearby, Beeden. The dining club?"
"Yes, sir." "Hoban, sir. A short walk."
The year's first snow began to fall as he made his way up Chancery Lane, a dry, gritty stuff that seemed unlikely to adhere to the paving. Boots and Becky Dean were nowhere to be seen, which could reliably be taken to mean that they were about their customarily invisible business. You know well enough how it's done. And didn't he? How many had been made to vanish utterly in London alone? How could one sit among friends at pleasant little dinners, sipping Moselle, listening to kind and careless talk, yet carry in one's mind the burden of such knowledge? He'd meant Collins to be the last, absolutely the last. Now Betteridge had gone, and at the hands of another agency. In the beginning it had made so horribly elegant a sort of sense. In the beginning, it had been his idea. The eye. He sensed it now. Yes, surely, its all-seeing gaze full upon him as he nodded to the tasselled doorman and entered the marbled vestibule of the Lambs, Andrew Wakefield's dining club. Brass letter-boxes, a telegraph booth, an excess of French polished veneer, all thoroughly modern. He glanced back through glass doors to the street. Opposite the Lambs, beyond twin streams of snow-dusted traffic, he glimpsed a solitary figure in a tall derby hat. A page directed him to the grill-room, which was done in dark oak with an enormous fireplace topped with a mantle of carved Italian stone. "Lawrence Oliphant," he told the tightly jacketed head waiter, "for Mr. Andrew Wakefield." A look of unease crossed the man's face. "I'm sorry, sir, but he isn't." "Thank you," Oliphant said, "but I believe I see Mr. Wakefield." With the head waiter at his heels, Oliphant marched between the tables, diners turning as he passed. "Andrew," he said, arriving at Wakefield's table, "how very fortunate to find you here." Wakefield was dining alone. He seemed to experience a temporary difficulty in swallowing.
"Mr. Wakefield, sir," the head waiter began.
"My friend will be joining me," Wakefield said. "Sit down, please. We're attracting attention." "Thank you." Oliphant took a seat.
"Will you be dining, sir?" the head waiter asked.
"No, thank you." When they were alone, Wakefield sighed loudly.
"Damn it all, Oliphant, but didn't I make my terms clear?"
"What exactly is it, Andrew, of which you've become so frightened?"
"It should be fairly obvious."
"Should it?"
"Lord Galton's in league with your bloody Mr. Egremont. He's the great patron of criminal anthropometry. Always has been. Their virtual founder. He's Charles Darwin's cousin, Oliphant, and he wields great influence in the House of Lords."
"Yes, and in the Royal Society, and in the Geographical as well. I'm thoroughly familiar with Lord Galton, Andrew. He espouses the systematic breeding of the human species." Wakefield put down his knife and fork.
"Criminal anthropometry have effectively taken over the Bureau. For all intents and purposes, the Central Statistics Bureau is now under Egremont's control."
Oliphant watched as Wakefield's upper teeth began to worry at his lower lip.
"I've just come from Fleet Street," Oliphant said.
the level of violence in this society—and he drew the baluster Molina from within his coat—or rather, I should say, the level of unacknowledged violence has become remarkable, don't you think, Andrew?" He placed the revolver on the linen between them. "Take this pistol as an example. All too readily obtainable, I'm told. It is of Franco-Mexican manufacture, though the invention of Spaniards. Certain of its internal parts, I am informed, springs and what not, are actually British, available on the open market. It becomes rather difficult, then, to say where a weapon like this comes from. Emblematic of something in our current situation, don't you think?" Wakefield had gone quite white. "But I seem to have upset you, Andrew. I'm sorry."
"They'll erase us," Wakefield said. "We'll cease to exist. There'll be nothing left. Nothing to prove either of us ever lived. Not a check stub, not a mortgage in a city bank, nothing whatever.
Exactly what I'm on about, Andrew."
"Don't take that moral tone with me, sir," Wakefield said. "Your lot began it, Oliphant. The disappearances, the files gone missing, the names expunged, numbers lost, histories edited to suit specific ends. No, don't take that tone with me."
Oliphant could think of nothing to say. He rose, leaving the pistol on the tablecloth, and left the grill room without looking back. "Pardon me," he said, in a marbled vestibule, to a burgundy-jacketed bellman who was sifting cigar ends from a sand-filled marble urn. "But could you please direct me to the office of the club steward?"
"You bet," the bellman said, or some similar bit of American dialect, and led Oliphant smartly away down a corridor lined with mirrors and rubber plants.
55 minutes later, having toured the club's premises at some length, having been shown a photographic album of the Lamb's annual Gambles, having applied for membership and having paid a not inconsiderable initiation fee, non-refundable, via his own number in the National Credit, Oliphant shook hands with the pomaded steward, gave the man a pound note, and requested that he be let out by the club's most obscure trade entrance. This proved to be a scullery door which opened on exactly the sort of dank and narrow passage he had hoped for. Within a quarter of an hour he stood at the public bar of a crowded house in Bedford Road, reviewing the text of the telegram that one Sybil Gerard had once dispatched to Mr. Charles Egremont, M.P. of Belgravia.
"Dost both me boys a sickness in the Crimea, squire? And in it always the telegram comes, in it."
Oliphant folded the sheet of foolscap into his cigar case. He watched his dim reflection in the polished zinc of the bar. He looked at his empty tumbler. He looked up at the woman, a raddled harridan in rags gone a colour that had no name, her cheeks roseate with gin blossoms under a patina of grime. "No," he said, "that tragedy is not mine."
"Me Roger it was," she said, "and Tommy lad too, and not a rag come home, squire. Not a bloody rag."
He handed her a coin. She thanked him, mumbling, and retreated. He seemed to have thoroughly slipped the traces for the moment. He was entirely alone. It was time to find a cab. In the dim, high hollow of the great station, 1,000 voices seemed to mingle, the constituent elements of language reduced to the oral equivalent of fog, homogeneous and impenetrable. Oliphant went about his business below at a measured and deliberate pace, purchasing a first-class railway ticket to Dover, reserved for the 10 o'clock evening express. The ticket clerk seated Oliphant's National Credit plate in the machine and cranked hard on the lever.
"There you are, sir. Reserved in your name."
Thanking the clerk, Oliphant made his way to a second wicket, where he again produced his plate.
"I wish to book a cabinet on the morning mail boat to Ostend."
Apparently as an afterthought, as he was putting the boat tickets and his National Credit plate into his note-case, he requested a second-class ticket on the midnight boat to Calais.
"Would that be this evening, sir?"
"Yes."
"That will be the Bessemer, sir. On National Credit, sir?"
Oliphant paid for the ticket to Calais with pound notes from Mr. Beeden's safe. 10 till 9 by his father's gold hunter. At 9 o'clock he boarded a departing train at the last possible moment, paying the first-class fare to Dover directly to the conductor. The swinging saloon ship Bessemer, her twin turtle decks awash with Dover spray, steamed for Calais sharp on the midnight. Oliphant, having visited the purser with his second-class ticket and his pound notes, was seated in a brocade armchair in the saloon cabin, sipping mediocre brandy and taking the measure of his fellow passengers. They were, he was pleased to note, a thoroughly unremarkable lot. He disliked swinging saloons, finding the engine-controlled movements of the cabin intended to compensate for the vessel's pitch and roll somehow more unsettling than the ordinary motion of a ship at sea. In addition, the cabin itself was effectively windowless. Swung on gimbals in a central well, the cabin was mounted so deeply in the hull that its windows, such as they were located high up along the walls, well above one's line of sight. All in all, as a remedy for mal de mer, Oliphant thought it excessive. The public, however, were apparently fascinated by the novel employment of a small engine, somewhat on the order of a gunnery engine, whose sole task consisted of maintaining as near a level footing in the cabin as was deemed possible. This was accomplished via something the press referred to, in Clacker's argo, as backfeed. Still, with twin paddles fore and aft, the Bessemer customarily performed the distance of 21 miles between Dover and Calais in 1 hour and 30 minutes. He would rather have been above decks, now facing into the wind, able then, perhaps, to imagine himself steaming toward some grander, more accessible goal. But the promenade of a swinging saloon offered no bulwark, only an iron railing, and the channel wind was damp and cold. And he had, he reminded himself, only the one goal now, and it, in all likelihood, a fool's errand. Still, Sybil Gerard. He had decided upon reading the telegram to Egremont against having her number spun. He had expected it might attract unwanted attention. With criminal anthropometry holding sway at Central Statistics, of course, he had been proven correct, and he rather suspected that Sybil Gerard's file might no longer exist. Walter Gerard of Manchester, sworn enemy of progress, agitator for the rights of man. Hang. And if Walter Gerard had had a daughter, what might have become of her? And if she had been ruined, as she claimed to have been, by Charles Egremont? Oliphant's back began to ache. Beneath the chair's stiff brocade, jacquard woven with repeated images of the Bessemer, the horsehair stuffing held a chill. But if nothing else, he reminded himself, he at least had temporarily escaped the soft, black pit of Dr. McNeil's patent Swiss bathtub. Putting his brandy aside unfinished, he nodded then and napped, and dreamed, perhaps, of the eye. The Bessemer docked at Calais at 1:30. Monsieur Lucien Astlot's apartments were in Passy. At noon Oliphant presented his car to the concierge, who conveyed it via pneumatic tube to Monsieur Astlot's establishment. Almost immediately, the whistle attached to a nickelled speaking tube peeped twice. The concierge bent his ear to the funnel. Oliphant made out faint tones of shouted French. The concierge showed Oliphant to the lift. He was admitted on the 5th floor by a liveried manservant wearing an ornate Corsican stiletto through a pleated sash of Gros de Naples. The young man managed to bow without taking his eyes from Oliphant. Monsieur Asselot regretted, the servant said, that he was unable at the moment to receive Monsieur Oliphant. In the meantime, would Monsieur Oliphant care for any sort of refreshment? Oliphant declared that he would very much appreciate an opportunity to bathe. He would also find a pot of coffee most agreeable. He was led through a broad drawing-room, rich in satin and ormolu. Boule cabinets, bronzes, statuettes, and porcelain, where the lizard-eyed emperor and his dainty empress, the former Miss Howard, gazed from twin portraits in oil. And then through a morning-room hung with proof engravings, a graceful curve of stairway mounted from an octagonal anteroom. Some 2 hours later, having bathed in a marble-rimmed tub of gratifying solidity, having taken strong French coffee and lunched upon cutlets à la Maintenon, and wearing borrowed linen with far more starch than he cared for, he was ushered into the study of Monsieur Asselot.
"Mr. Oliphant, sir," Asselot said in his excellent English, "it is a great pleasure. I regret not having been able to see you earlier, but—"
He gestured toward a broad mahogany desk littered with files and papers. From behind a closed door came the steady clatter of a telegraph. On one wall hung a framed engraving of the great Napoleon, its mighty gear towers rising behind a gridwork of plate glass and iron.
"Not at all, Lucien. I'm grateful to have had the time to take advantage of your hospitality. Your chef has an extraordinary way with mutton, a sublimated meat that could scarcely have grown on any mundane sheep."
Arslo smiled. Nearly Oliphant's height, broader in the shoulders, he was some 40 years of age and wore his greying beard in the imperial fashion.
His cravat was embroidered with small golden bees. "I've had your letter, of course." He returned to his desk and settled himself in a high-backed chair, upholstered in dark green leather. Oliphant took a seat in an armchair opposite.
"I must admit my curiosity, Lawrence, as to what it is you are currently about."
Arslo made a steeple of his fingers and peered over them, raising his eyebrows.
"The nature of your request would hardly seem to warrant the precautions you deem necessary."
"On the contrary, Lucien, you must know that I would not presume in this way upon our acquaintance for any but the most pressing of reasons."
"But no, my friend," Arslo said, with a dismissive little wave of his hands. "You have asked the merest of favours. Among colleagues, men such as ourselves, it is nothing. I am simply curious. It is one of my many vices. You convey to me a letter by imperial diplomatic pouch, no mean feat in itself for an Englishman, though I know that you are familiar with our friend Bayard. Your letter requires my help in locating a certain English adventuress, no more. You believe she may be resident in France, yet you stress the need for very great secrecy. You warn me particularly against communicating with you either by telegraph or by the regular post. You instruct me to await your arrival. What am I to make of this? Have you succumbed at last to the wiles of some woman? Alas, I have not. Given the current model of English womanhood, my friend, I find that entirely understandable. Far too many of your gentlewomen aspire to be elevated to the level of masculine intellectuality, superior to crinoline, superior to pearl powder, above taking the pains to be pretty, above making themselves agreeable in any way. What a dreary, utilitarian, entirely ugly life an Englishman shall eventually lead if this trend continues. So why, then, I ask, have you crossed the channel to find an English adventuress? Not that we haven't our share of them. They're rather thick upon the ground, actually, not to mention the origin, Arslo smiled, of our own empress.
You yourself have never married, Lucien, Oliphant remarked, attempting to deflect Arslo from his purpose.
But look at matrimony.
Who is to say which shall be the one judicious selection out of the 999 mistakes? Which is to be the one eel out of the barrel of snakes? The girl on the capstone may be the one woman out of every female creature in this universe capable of making me a happy man, my friend. Yet I pass her by, and bespatter her with the mud from my wheels in my utter ignorance.
Arslo laughed. No, I have not married, and your mission is a political one.
Of course.
Things are not well with Britain. I don't need my British sources to tell me that, Oliphant. The papers suffice. The death of Byron.
Great Britain's political direction, Lucien. Indeed, her ultimate stability as a nation may even now be at stake. I need not remind you of the paramount importance of our two nations' continued mutual recognition and support.
And the matter of this Miss Gerard, Oliphant. Shall I take it you suggest she is somehow pivotal in the situation?
Oliphant took out his cigar case and selected one of Beeden's Habanas. His fingers brushed the folded text of Sybil Gerard's telegram. He closed the case.
Do you mind if I smoke?
Please do.
Thank you. The matters which hinge upon Sybil Gerard are entirely British, entirely domestic. They may stand ultimately to affect France, but in a most indirect way.
Oliphant clipped and pierced his cigar.
Are you entirely sure of that?
I am.
I am not.
Arslo rose to bring Oliphant a copper ashtray atop a walnut stand. He returned to his desk but remained standing.
What do you know of the Jacquardine Society?
They are the approximate equivalent of our Steam Intellect Society, are they not?
Yes and no. There is another, a secret society within the Jacquardines. They style themselves les filles de Vaucanson. Certain of them are anarchists, others in league with the Marianne, others with the Universal Fraternity, others with any sort of rabble. Class war conspirators, you understand? Others are simply criminals. But you know this, Lawrence.
Oliphant took a lucifer from a box emblazoned with a stippled image of the Bessemer and struck it. He lit his cigar.
You tell me that the woman you know as Sybil Gerard is of no concern to France, Arslo said.
You think otherwise?
Perhaps. Tell me what you know of our difficulties with the great Napoleon.
Very little. Wakefield of Central Statistics mentioned it to me. The engine is no longer functioning accurately.
Ordinateurs, thank the good God, are not my specialty. The Napoleon performs with his accustomed speed and accuracy in most instances, I am informed, but an outre element of inconstancy presently haunts the machine's higher functions. Arslow sighed. Those higher functions being deemed a matter of considerable national pride, I have myself been forced to peruse reams of the most abstruse technical prose in the Empire. To no ultimate avail, it now seems, as we've had the culprit in hand.
The culprit?
An avowed member of Les Filles de Vaucanson. His name was of no importance. He was arrested in Lyon in connection with an ordinary case of civil fraud involving a municipal ordinateur. Elements of his subsequent confession brought him to the attention of the Commission of Special Services, and hence to ours. During interrogation, he revealed his responsibility for the current lamentable state of our great Napoleon.
He confessed to le sabotage, then?
No, he would not confess to that. He refused, until the end. With regard to the Napoleon, he would admit only to having run a certain sequence of punch cards, a mathematical formula.
Oliphant watched the smoke from his cigar spiral toward the high ceiling's ornate plaster rosette.
"The formula came from London," Arslow continued. "He obtained it from an Englishwoman. Her name was Sybil Gerard.
Have you attempted analysis of this formula?"
"No. It was stolen, our Jacadin claimed, spirited away by a woman he knew as Flora Bartel, apparently an American."
"I see."
Then tell me what you see, my friend, for I myself am very much in the dark.
The eye, all-seeing, the sublime weight of its perception pressing in upon him from every direction. Oliphant hesitated. Ash from his cigar fell unnoticed to Arslo's rich carpet.
I have yet to meet Sybil Gerard, he said, but I may be able to offer you information regarding this formula you've mentioned. It may even be possible to obtain a copy. I can promise nothing, however, until I myself am allowed to interview the lady in question, privately and at some length.
Arslo fell silent. He seemed to look through Oliphant. At last he nodded.
We can arrange that. She is not, I take it, in custody?
Let us say that we are aware of her movements.
You allow her apparent freedom, yet observe her closely?
Precisely that. If we take her now, and she reveals nothing, the trail goes cold.
As ever, Arslaw, your technique is impeccable. And when might it be arranged for me to meet with her?
The eye, the pressure, the pounding of his heart.
This evening, if you so desire, said Monsieur Arslaw,
of the Police des Châteaux, adjusting his gold-embroidered cravat.